Now stay tuned for To Your Health, where food is on the table and center stage. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating over 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. And by Rebecca's Natural Foods in the Barracks Road Shopping Center. Now here is your host, MC Blair.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, everybody. This is MC Blair, and this is To Your Health on 94.7 WPVC,
the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Also the voice of resistance right here in beautiful Charlottesville. I'm sitting here with my friend John Hill, and we were going to talk about home gardens. So
yeah, wrong mic.
Yeah, that one.
You got wrong mic. That's okay.
Yeah, we don't know anything about radio here.
Yeah, right.
let's talk. Whatever you want to
really.
Talk
what,
about.
Yeah, really. So what you did, oh gosh, you were at Twin Oaks for a long time their garden over there. And I know you have one now, so.
Yeah, my grandfather had a 2,000-acre farm in eastern North Carolina.
Oh, my.
1,000 acres cleared. And he had 16 grandchildren, and only two of us were interested in the farm. And so I kind of got the bug. I didn't grow up on a farm or anything like that, but I got the bug. My mom taught me as a little kid. My mom taught me how to grow radishes, you know. Uh-huh. That's the quick thing for
it
kids.
It is. Yeah, it's a good
like
one to start with.
You plant some radishes and you get to see results really fast.
Absolutely.
You know? So she got me a little started, and then I got really interested in my granddad's farm. And in 75, I moved to Twin Oaks Community out near Louisa. And immediately I started working in the gardens, and all organic gardens. You know, we had about 3 acres, something like that, of organic gardens. And we had 130 acres later. But when I moved there, we had 30 acres under cultivation and just the gardens. And then we grew hay and stuff because there was a dairy out there and cows and everything. So I was working every area in the garden. Like, the garden had a manager, okay? And every sub-area, like, every little crop had a mother, you know? That's what the current manager called it. You're the mother. So I became the tomato mother. And we had a lot of tomatoes. I mean, we had, I think, about 300 tomato plants. So it was planting them and staking them, you know, and doing all that and getting all that ready. And then I lived there almost 5 years, and I worked in the gardens the whole time.
Oh, my.
And after about 3.5 years, we bought another farm. It was another 100 acres 3 miles down the road called the Lawson Land. And Mr. Lawson had been the farmer there. And so we went from 30 acres to 130 acres, and our farm manager left. And so two other guys and myself became the farm managers, like a co-managership. And we were trying to convert. We never used herbicides and pesticides ever, but we did on the field crops, on the hay, soybeans, wheat, that kind of thing. We were using commercial fertilizers. But we were converting. We were trying to convert to all organic. So we went to spreading pig manure on the pasture crops, like on the hay and stuff like that. And we had other plans to do it with field crops as well. And mm-hmm. we were raising wheat and soybeans and barley. And one year we even raised 15 acres of sunflowers. That was really fun. And we kind of had them hauled out at a stone grinding mill down the road from us.
Oh my.
And bagged them up and took them up to a place in D.C., a wholesale place called Community Warehouse that specialized in natural foods and stuff. But anyway, that's kind of how I got started in gardening. And then I always had a home garden ever after my days at Twin Oaks when I lived in the Charlottesville area. I moved back to Charlottesville in 81. And then I'd say mid-80s, I started raising produce again, organic produce, and selling it on the farmer's market here. And I had my own produce stand as well down off the 250 bypass.
Oh, wow, that's really cool. So you recently moved, so have you put in a garden yet?
I haven't put in a garden there yet because Mostly, you know, I mean, you know, Mike, I had a stroke in 2012.
Right.
And I recovered really well, but I still have, you know, I'm still not that, I don't have great balance and everything. Mm-hmm. And I don't have as much stamina as I used to. But my plan is certainly next year I'm going to try to have a garden there. I really want to do it. I haven't, since I had some health problems earlier in, you know, just in the last decade or mm-hmm. two, I haven't had a home garden, and the only thing I've had is occasionally some potted things on the patio I was living. But I really want to have another garden. When I wasn't growing commercially and selling things, I always had a home garden, and I'm just missing it so much.
Yeah, I bet all those years of doing it.
And have one again. I love to grow things.
Yeah. Well, what I find is interesting, and some people, they say, well, I don't have any land, you know, I can't, or I live in a condo community, and I can't plow stuff, or I can't put a garden in. And just say, well, get some pots and put it on your porch, and you can grow. And if you've got two people or three, man, you can have fresh.
You can grow so many things in pots. You can grow tomatoes, cherry tomatoes. Since I was laid up, when the years I was laid up a little, I had cherry tomatoes and peppers.
Right.
And you can grow strawberries, you know, if you want to do that. You can. There's just tons of most things. You know, the things you can't grow are corn and mm-hmm. cantaloupe and watermelon. You need a lot of space
sure.
for those things.
Yeah.
But anything you can grow that doesn't take up a lot of space, you can grow greens. You can, you know, just get a pot and broadcast some kale seed or some mustard seed mm-hmm. in there. You know, boom, all of a sudden you'll have a patch. And if you do it in a pot, you don't have any worries about reaching it when you pick it. You just bend over and
right.
pick it. So you can plant the whole pot. Just bend over and pick it, you know. People underestimate themselves sometimes, especially if they don't have much experience. I've met so many people that have told me, I don't have a green thumb, I kill everything I try to grow and all that kind of stuff. And I just figure, I'm not anything special. I'm no different than them. I just feel like I don't have that little mental thing
block,
going on, says, you know, that you can't grow it. Because one of the things that I learned through the years that I felt like was a personal lesson was that plants love to grow. That's where I finally came to that place. No matter how you fertilize them, no matter what you do to make them feel special and, you know, part of your family, like you're like instead of a dog, you got some plants, you know.
Right, right.
But they love to grow. And so what you have to do is just do a little bit of preparation. Get the seed or the plants into the ground and then just kind of get out of the way. And only, excuse me, I got something frog in my throat. The only thing, you know, sometimes soil conditions, pH, will affect if you're not having success growing things. And the soil mix, of course, is very important in what you put in it. But beyond that, beyond your preparation and planning, I just say just kind of move out of the way and let the plants do the thing.
Yeah. It's funny how, you know, the survival mechanism is in everything, of course. And I've seen plants that they look dead. And my friend said, let's give it one more shot. So he uprooted it, trimmed the roots, put it back in the soil, watered it pretty good. And the next day you could see little parts of green starting to pop up. And just little parts, you know, and he said, there you go. And I said, I've never seen anybody trim the roots. Yep. You got to do that sometimes, you know, and they keep getting, it's amazing. They just want to keep growing.
You know, a story to help sort of novice gardeners mm-hmm. is when I was in college, I was busy with a million things and I didn't always pay attention to things like plants. And a friend of mine gave me a coleus plant, you know, because I was taking, it came from a class I was taking, NC State University. I was taking a class in horticulture. Mm-hmm. It was a really interesting class, and coleuses were pretty easy to root, you know. So we were doing root cuttings we're doing leaf cuttings or stem cuttings and then rooting them, you know, in some soil.
Right.
So, you know, I had this little coleus plant left over from my class, and I put it in a Coors beer can. I took the top off the Coors beer can. I put it in a Coors beer can. And then, you know, just it's college. You got so many different interests. I wasn't really interested at that point, particularly in the coleus, but, you know, it just kind of never got any attention, and it would get so dry because the can's small, you know, and that if I forgot to water it, it would look like a dead stick.
Right.
Okay. And then I'd water it, and a leaf would come back, and more leaves would come back, you know, and then it would die, look dead again. I bet it happened like 5 or 6 times. And when I left college, I gave it to my friend's wife, who they lived in the dorms. He was an RA. He was kind of one of the really king cheese RAs. He had a suite for married people.
Oh, okay.
You know, I gave it to her, and I forgot about it. And then it was years later, I got interested in plants and growing things more. And then I went to their house like 25 years later or something, and there's this huge coleus plant like overtaking a couple of tables and countertops and everything. And she didn't say anything, and after a little while she said, "Do you recognize that plant?" And I had totally forgotten about it.
Sure.
And I said, "No, you know, I don't." And she said, "That's the coleus that you gave me at NC State." And my mouth just dropped open because that thing had looked like a dead stick like 5 or 6 times.
Yeah.
So I'm telling you, don't ever give up on something like that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
You can, you know, plants have their own intelligence.
They do.
And they have the energy of life behind them. And, you know, unless you do something really radical. You know how one example of that is when you have volunteers to spring up in your compost pile, or you know, somewhere where seeds have spilled out from other things that you've grown, and all of a sudden you have tomatoes or a pepper plant or some herbs just growing. It's like that, you know, they're going to try to find a way to grow.
Mm.
They really
are.
That's
true. It's true.
And that's why I say, you know, get them in the ground. Do good preparation. Get them in the ground. And then just step back, really, and just let them grow. And I took that philosophy, whether I was growing 4, 5, 6, 7 acres of produce, or whether I was growing 35 acres of, you know, wheat or something like that.
Right.
You know, we had wheat, soybeans, like I said, barley, and we combined them all and, you know, put them in a grain bin we built, and then at Twin Oaks, and then we would sell them when the time was right, when the price was right. But just, you know, I'd say if you're interested in gardening, just give it a try.
Yeah.
Maybe get somebody who find a friend, or, you know, get somebody who knows a little bit more than you do. And just get some help in the beginning. But after that, it's all your baby, you know.
Yeah.
And there's so much to learn. But when you've got good, fresh food, Twin Oaks had big gardens, you know, and there were between 50 and 100 adults, depending on when I was there in that 5-year period I lived there. And we did not live off the land completely. We bought some things, you know, we bought some food. But during the summers, oh my goodness, we had a bounty of every kind of fresh vegetable, every kind of thing you could think of. I'd bring stuff in from the gardens in wheelbarrows, and I'd tell other Twin Oaks members, people living there, and say, "There's a cantaloupe quota this month. You have to eat like 1.5 a day." You
know? Yeah, right.
I was just kidding. Or yeah. You have to eat 2 a day, because we just have wheelbarrows. You know how many tomatoes, 300 tomato plants produce?
Yeah,
when things are really rolling, like July and August, and we would can tomatoes and do all kinds of stuff with them and do a lot of cooking with them. But, you know, you have a bounty, and there's nothing like it. Fresh food right out of your own garden.
Yep.
Tastes incredible. When you eat little lettuces, you know, you eat like beet greens or something like that, you know, or even fresh beets or fresh anything, really. The taste is incredible.
Well, that too, and then also the nutrition is fabulous. You know, your lettuces, within 30 minutes of harvest, lose half their nutrition.
Is that right?
Yeah, and so if you're cutting them right off the right there and eating them fresh, my goodness, you know, you can't get any better than that. And that's why I always liked, I used to go pick tomatoes in the field, and I'd always carry a little salt shaker with me, and I'm like eating, I'm eating it as I go along, you know.
And that's, you know, the way to go.
I know, right?
When we raised a fair amount of sweet corn at Twin Oaks and popcorn, you know, that's really interesting. And but you know, I would be out picking corn, and one time I had here in Charlottesville, in the Charlottesville area, I had 5 acres of sweet corn, you know, the Silver Queen and some other stuff that I was growing and picking. And I'd be out in the field. I just would eat it raw. You know, you pick an ear, just shuck it partway down and start eating it because it just tastes so good.
Oh, it's so sweet. And of course,
so unbelievable.
Of course, it's funny because when I was in Spain, John, you know, the Americans would eat corn and the Spaniards would look at us funny and say, well, what are you eating corn for? That's animal feed.
Yeah.
You know, and it's true, they don't eat corn, but and if you look at the makeup of it, you know, we can't really digest it as evidenced, you know, when you
the other side of things.
Yeah. And it's starch and sugar. And so that's why they don't eat it over there in Spain. It's real interesting. But they feed it to their pigs, you know, and now they will give it to their beef cattle, unfortunately. And, of course, that makes them sick because the ruminants aren't allowed to or can't digest corn and grain in general. And so it just ferments in their, you know, in their body, and it gives them a thing called acidosis, which is makes them sick, you know. So that's why I just get grass-fed beef. But, you know, one of the things that I have found out through my research and talking to people on this show about gardens is the community-based agriculture. Now, that's not a CSA, a community-supported agriculture where you get a box of food every week.
Right.
It's community-based, meaning the whole community gets together and meets in the garden and works in the garden, you know, a certain number of hours. And all of a sudden you find people, especially kids, you know, with maybe from different cultures or different skin colors, and they get along in the garden. And then, of course, the parents do when they're in the garden. And next thing you know, you have a whole community of woke people, if you will, you know, to the other cultures, and so they get along, and so then you have eventually you'll have an adult society that's getting along, and that's
good
from community-based agriculture.
Very good point. There are a lot of urban projects through the decades for, you know, doing community gardens right in the thick of a very big city.
Yeah.
And Charlottesville has garden space right still.
They do, and
in the community gardens.
Yes, and the Urban Agricultural Collective of Charlottesville (UACC), and they're doing wonderful things. You know, they opened up one at South First Street, and then of course the one at Friendship Court, and there are a couple of others. I'm not exactly sure where they are. I went around with a farmer Todd, who's no longer doing that particular project. But he took me to all the gardens, and we met the folks, and I helped him. I helped him harvest some things, you know, while we were there.
Yeah,
we got some cucumbers and some other things, and it was really fun, you know, just getting down there and getting your hands dirty.
Well, people really love fresh food when they get it,
you know,
even if they're not quite used to it. It's like a really good baked goods, you know. People love that.
Yeah.
And so if you, I'll give you an example of something that happened to me. When I left Twin Oaks and when I came to live in Charlottesville, I was looking for some land to lease. I didn't own any land. And, you know, I was living in the city, and I started asking around and putting up notices on bulletin boards at places like Gleason's, which is no longer there, but you know, they had Farm Supply and other places, and even a neighbor of mine heard that I was looking and said, you can use my side yard. I wanted more space than that, but she said, you can use this vacant lot, you know, because she was just so thrilled that somebody my age, that she was older, somebody my age was interested in growing something.
That's amazing.
In the city. You know, people are good.
We got to take a break. You're listening to Your Health on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And we will return. Hey, we're back. This is MC Blair, and we're talking with my friend John Hill. And we are going to talk a little bit more about community gardens and about home gardens and how much good that does for the community and for your soul and for your health.
So. It's really good for your soul. I used to sort of have a daydream that instead of so many lawns in a city that you just see half of the lawn would not be lawn. It would be gardens, you know. And, people have said for years that we're running out of land and, you know, there's not enough agricultural land in some areas and everything. And I don't believe them because I think we're running out of land when there's, you know, when, I mean, you know, what about all the lawns? People could be growing corn in their front yard if they wanted to. You know, you drive down the street. You know, we've got all this land that's just could be, you know, used for productive agriculture. In smaller countries, if you go to Europe, they're gardening everywhere, you know, and they might have to terrace some areas because the slope is so great. Or you look, even in Holland, I was there, they were gardening the railroad right of way because it's a small place. So everything they could do to have fresh food, they were doing it.
Well, how about the schools? They're you know, city schoolyard gardens.
Right.
And they're getting the kids involved, and they do wonderful work with those kids. And they do have many instances of people, you know, of different colors and, you know, cultures. All of a sudden, they're getting along, and their parents, you know, they were kind of taught to, you know, be wary of that, of those people, whoever those people are.
Right, whoever they are,
Somebody different than yourself, I guess.
It used to be when I had long hair down halfway down my back.
You were those people.
Yeah, you were one of those people.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And so it's amazing. And so when the kids come there with their parents' voices in their heads, and then they're working in the garden beside one of those people, all of a sudden they're going, you know, those white people, those black people, those, you know, Oriental people, whoever it is, they're not too bad, you know. And it's and then they can go home and say, you know, Dad, Mom, whatever. You're wrong, you know. And I mean, it's just amazing, and it's all because they're gardening, they're growing, they're bringing life into the world, and that's
what wasn't
rewarding.
There a movie, White Men Can't Hoe? I think Wesley Snipes was in that. I can't remember. No, Mike, you have a really good point. All those things are really good points. The key to everything in this world is not just what you're doing. It's really who you're doing it with and how you're getting along.
Right.
It's everything is a vehicle. If you look at it that way, everything can be used as a vehicle.
Absolutely.
For more community, better relationships, better everything.
And I think that we can, if a concerted effort by the folks with means in this community, Charlottesville and surrounding counties, got together and focused on food security, that we could probably cut the amount of food that's bought commercially way down.
I think the sky would be the limit.
Yeah, I mean, the greenhouses in the winter to supply produce, and then people work there and they get food and, you know, a nice thing. Yeah. And then also the people hired there to work full time, you pay them a nice living wage. And, of course, then they don't have to work three jobs.
Yeah, and then they have food
and they have food to take home. It's much more a better environment. And then in the summertime, you can run intern programs through the greenhouses just to show them how they work. But then the produce is supplied by the surrounding farms. So as opposed to the greenhouses taking away from the surrounding farms, so you don't want that to happen.
I'm really big on cooperative efforts.
Yeah.
My years at Twin Oaks, I got very involved And then later, too, I got very involved in the food co-op movement. You know, that was real big in the 60s, 70s.
Yeah, it was.
80s. I don't know. You know, there's food co-ops popping up everywhere. In fact, you know, Integral Yoga Natural Foods
started off as
used
a co-op.
To be a food co-op.
Right.
Blue Mountain Trading Company.
I remember, yeah.
You know, and so, you know, that was always an interesting thing because you just, if people don't know how that worked, it was, you know, you had a management, a small management staff, and then all the co-op, all the other people were members, and all those members just came in and did some shifts every month to work the place and help customers and whatever, you know. And so it was the members themselves that were running most of the business of the co-op with maybe a manager or a little bit of a staff. And, you know, you could get great whole grains and foods, whole foods there, and local produce and all kinds of stuff. And Charlottesville used to have more co-ops than they do now.
Yeah, now I know
there was one in Crozet.
They're operating as a regular store now. They do still really hit hard on locally produced foods.
Yeah, they do. They're one of those stores in town that they
So if you can't get it from a farm, folks, you can go to IY and get it at the same time and or get good food. And at the very least, it's going to be organic. So, you know, and even though it came from Chile or California or whatever, I always wondered if they lose their nutrition after harvesting, how much nutrition is left when it, you know, comes from South America or California.
Well, but if you're thinking of other people, though, it's just imagine all the crew on the ships and the captain and everything. They're getting some nutrition before it gets here. So those guys are really, like, they're beefing up, so to speak.
Oh, my goodness gracious. That's funny. Yeah, we are listening to Your Health on WPVC 94.7. And it's the voice of resistance and the progressive voice right here in Charlottesville. And we're talking with John Hill about gardening.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Mike.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you, John. And it's, you know, the kids, I mean, my gosh, you know, if the kids are eating healthily, then there'll be less cases of childhood obesity, type 2 diabetes. So that's less health costs. And all of a sudden, if families save money on health costs, they have the money to, you know, maybe pay a little more for the organic and the local produce.
Right.
You know, it's just a win-win, I believe, and that's why I think that, you know, the community-based agriculture is the way to go.
I ran the kitchens at Twin Oaks for about 4 years. And I didn't do all the cooking. I ordered all the food and kept it real, you know, organized and tidy. And then I cook a few times a week. But so many of the members out there love to cook, so they got scheduled to cook as much as they wanted to.
Right.
But one thing that I always felt there, even from the time I think when I was much younger at home, I felt that the kitchen is the center of the universe, really. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the center of any. Anything, the family, a community like Twin Oaks, and really having great food, clean food, and an organized and clean environment to cook and eat in, you know, was very important to me. So, you know, we tried, even the food we didn't grow, we tried to get really high quality food.
Yeah. Were you the one who told me when you would go into Twin Oaks to cook? It was your turn in the kitchen, that the first thing you would do is take some onions and maybe some peppers or whatever and just put them in a big skillet and saute them off just for the smell.
Well, it wasn't me. It was another guy that lived at Twin Oaks.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Josh, he was in charge of the dairy, you know?
Right.
But he cooked once or twice a week, probably about once a week.
Right.
Josh would come in. And we had a giant cast iron skillet.
Right, yeah.
And he would just throw onions and peppers and aromatic things, you know, in there. And he would saute them. And most of the time he'd use that in some dish.
Sure.
But sometimes he didn't. Sometimes he'd just throw it away. And he'd say, because the most important thing, you have to get people interested in the food, because through the day people would wander into the kitchen dining building, you know, they wander in and out, and the aromas, you know, around say from 4 to 6 dinner, you know, 4 to dinner time would be really strong when Josh was cooking, and they'd always say, "Oh man, that smells great! I can't wait for dinner," you know. So he'd get their appetites really stimulated.
Yeah.
And he said that, and he loved to use colors in his cooking,
always
like red, you know, red peppers, green peppers, mix of, like maybe yellow squash, and a mix of colors, because he thought that was really appetizing for people. But it was just funny to have him like saute all that stuff off, just so when people walked in the building, they could smell it, you know?
Yeah.
And then we decided another way to get them kind of knowing more and interrupting us less was we made this little handmade clock. It wasn't a mechanical clock. It had hands on it, wooden clock, and you could just move the hands to whatever time you wanted. So dinner was usually at 6, but if we were running late and it was going to be 6:20 or something, we just put the clock to 6:20. So it was right at the end of a hallway, so they could see it. When you walk in the building, you could see the clock and say, "Oh, dinner's not going to be ready till 6:20. Instead of 80 people coming by and going, "What time's dinner?" You know,
right,
is it going to be on time tonight?
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, no, that's a great idea.
So we had that going on too. But, you know, we had our own dairy. Oh, man. All the fresh, unpasteurized milk you ever could want in your life, you know. And we weren't selling it, so we didn't have to pasteurize it. And we made homemade cottage cheese, homemade yogurt, and we tried cheeses, hard cheeses, and at that time it didn't work out because I guess we were doing something wrong. But several times we were trying cheeses in the root cellar, and you know, that didn't work out. But after I left Twin Oaks, they started making all sorts of seasoned and herbed soft cheeses, you know, for the refrigerator, like cream cheese, milk. We made milk cheese too, which is like cream cheese, but you're using milk instead of cream. And so, you know, it's a lighter product. But they had flavored all kinds, you know, 6-8 different flavors of milk or cream cheese, and just really, you know, a bountiful thing. I'd come into the kitchen building from working on the farm, and I'd be hot, you know, dusty, whatever, you know, been on a tractor for 5 hours. And, you know, we had a milk dispenser, a commercial milk dispenser, but it took a 5-gallon can up in the dispenser,
right,
and then kept it cold. And you fed a latex tube from the bottom of the can through a little weight, so that it's the kind of thing where you lift the weight and put your glass under it, and the milk comes out. And when the weight comes down, it pinches the tube off, so it would stop, you know. And I could just sit there, and if I wanted to, I could sit there and drink 3 or 4 glasses of milk. You know, it was nothing. And we had all the milk you want. And even when I've been back to visit Twin Oaks, when I have their milk, you know, because it's still unpasteurized, you know,
right,
fresh, amazing milk, I start a glass of milk and I go, "Oh my goodness, oh my God, that shit tastes so good."
Yeah, it does. Fresh, yeah. It's like right out of the cow, you know, and it's the best. Absolutely is the best. And there are some dairy farms in the area that you can buy milk shares. And it's whole milk, unpasteurized.
Yeah.
And it's the best because, of course, when you pasteurize it, you pretty much kill everything that's good in the milk because you have to heat it up and everything dies. And then they have to add back vitamin D and all the stuff that they, you know, add to milk. So you're basically, you know, you're getting some supplements. And it just, it's not in the original matrix of the vitamin. It's just not right.
I always thought it was strange that they add vitamin D to milk. Isn't vitamin D the sunlight vitamin?
Yes.
Like, all you got to do is spend like 15 minutes in the sun every day, and you get your quota of vitamin D. So I never understood. There's so many things about food additives and things that I don't understand. You know how, I guess they're still doing it. You know how they always would dye oranges, you know, orange?
Yeah.
And, you know, just because otherwise they thought, well, if it's not completely orange, doesn't look right to the customer or whatever they're thinking. One time I was in a grocery store with my mom and we were trying to buy some new potatoes, red potatoes, you know, and the dye, they had actually taken white new potatoes and dyed them red because the dye was coming off on my hands.
Oh, no.
You know, I picked up the potatoes.
Oh, no.
And I just could not believe it. You know, they used to, not so common anymore, but they used to wax and polish apples.
Oh,
you know,
I know.
Everything's got to look perfect.
Yeah.
And if we were talking, we're talking about this Thursday night, about if you live on a farm and you have a watermelon that's gotten a little bit extra ripe and you have a little bad spot in it, you know, you're the farmer. Well, all you do is cut it out with a knife,
yeah,
and then you slice the watermelon. It's probably the best watermelon you ever ate because it's really ripe and sweet, you know. And they don't, you know, you don't throw anything away on a farm.
Yeah, and it's really funny because when I go and I have to buy, if I can't buy sweet potatoes from the farmer that I get sweet potatoes from, Broadhead Mountain Farm.
Yeah, a little plug.
And a little plug for my Wally and Susan. And it comes in the fall, but I'll go to IY and there'll be locally grown sweet potatoes and they've got wormholes in them, you know, boreholes in them.
Yeah, sure.
And I say, oh, that's mine. You know, then I know it's done right.
Yeah.
But boy, if you put that sweet potato on in the bin at a regular grocery store, it'll still be there at the end of the day. It'll be the last one there, you know, because people see those holes and it's just, they don't know.
It's just lack of education.
It's exactly
That's
right.
All
lack
it
of education.
Is.
You're listening to Your Health on WPVC 94.7. Right here in Charlottesville, and I've been talking with John Hill. And thank you, John.
Really nice being here.
Yeah.
We'll do it again sometime.
Got to do it again. I would like to get a round table of folks in here.
Oh, that'd be lovely.
Another thing that we're going to be doing in the future fairly soon, I hope, are going to be talking about the vanishing pollinators and what is being done for the butterflies and the bees and all that, because right now I just saw an article. There were, like, normally in California, in this area that's on the butterfly migration route, there would be up to 10 million butterflies. And this past year, they estimated it to be about 300,000.
Oh, wow.
And
that's crazy.
Sad, you
it
know.
Sad.
I mean, 300,000 is a lot of butterflies, but 10 million is a whole lot more.
Yeah.
And that's what they were looking, you know, and you know, the migration of the butterfly is amazing. You know, it's like it takes them three full generations to get down to Mexico and South America, and then another three generations to get back to Canada, you know, the monarchs, how they migrate. And how do they know to keep going? You know, it's amazing.
I know they were having some trouble some years ago in the Midwest with the monarchs passing through with GMO corn, genetically modified corn, and that was causing a big problem. And I don't know what anybody's done about it, but you know, as we get further and further away from just the regular way. That things grew, you know, things growing without too much human interference.
Yeah.
As we get further and further away from that, there are problems that people can't even foresee. And Europeans have done a much better job at, banning a lot of things. You know, there's not GMO foods in Europe.
No,
you know?
They don't allow that.
They just said, we're not letting you do that.
Right.
You know, we're not letting you monkey with something where you don't even know what the outcome's going to
be. No, there's no factory farm chicken over there either. Mm-hmm. And you see them, they're hanging in the window. You know, it's just I've always liked that whole idea, you know, the real little market. And you know that everything in the market came from either in or just outside the town.
Oh, yeah,
you
know, that's right. And it used to be.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway. Well, thanks again, John.
Yeah,
it's been great.
This is a great show, Mike.
Thank you.
Really a community service.
I appreciate that. And I'm back. You're listening to Your Health, and we had just finished talking to John Hill about gardening and the value of community gardening. It's absolutely amazing what can be done working side by side other people in your community. Maybe you didn't otherwise meet them or know them, and how much good it does. I'm going to play an excerpt of an interview that I gave to a man named Carter Wallace. He was from Freshfields Farm. It's out in Afton. And wonderful, wonderful things they're doing there. Carbon sequestration and really getting close to the land and understanding what it is to farm the land properly without the use of chemical fertilizers or pesticides and herbicides. It's really amazing how much healthier the food is for you. So let's do that. And in the meantime, I'm going to try to get a hold of my Aunt Elizabeth, an activist out in Sacramento. And believe it or not, they were not getting fresh vegetables. So her, through her activism, they now have fresh vegetables every meal. So anyway, without further ado, let's listen to Carter Wallace.
Now, Carter, I mentioned earlier about food as medicine, and you actually said that you like to think of it more as agriculture as medicine. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I think probably like most people, I had a more specific calling to sort of redirect my attention and physical labor and such toward being more involved in agriculture as a producer. And then when you follow one specific calling, it opens up to a number of different callings. So for some people, it's maybe it's in a digestive disorder, that says, hey, I got to figure something else out. This is not working in my diet. For some people, it's just a disconnection from nature, and they follow that. For some people, it's just an aversion to pesticides on their apples. You know, I think what I've found is, particularly as we think about food as medicine, or as I observe the what might be posted about widely, food as medicine, it's a very true statement, and there's a lot in there, and it's really a gateway statement. It's a gateway to consider far more about what food is, and it's a gateway to consider not just what we eat, but how we eat it. And when one starts considering that, the desire to have a good apple, an apple that tastes good perhaps, or an apple that doesn't have pesticides on it, or an apple that built soil in the production of the apple as opposed to lost it. You start to really unravel a whole host of questions, and that is an invitation to a culture of the as medicine more than just the food as medicine. When we desire a really healthy food product, generally, and I can't say I could think of a counterexample to this, we're going to find that that's going to lead us all the way back to an entirely different lifestyle. And really, when you think of some, there's plenty of examples of really impressive yogis and such that...
I'm actually going to stop that right now because I have my Aunt Elizabeth on the phone, and we're going to talk to her about her activism. And Aunt Elizabeth, can you hear me?
Hello? Yes, I can hear you.
Oh,
you got
good.
Cut off for a minute.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead,
oh, good. So tell us about what you did, and when you got to your assisted living area or the, where you're living now, and how they didn't have fresh vegetables. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. In fact, when I moved in here, the food was atrocious.
Mm.
Starches, fried, everything, and no fresh vegetables. And here we sit in a valley of the bountiful grapes and all sorts of good vegetables.
Oh, I know. Sacramento Valley. Yeah. And it's amazing that they didn't have so. So how did you get them to do the fresh vegetables?
Very, very carefully. I started complaining to the cook and to the chef and about what we needed. I showed him lists of what we needed, how many vegetables, and his answer was the vegetables were in things. Well, they were little particles of a piece of veggie. And I kept, this took months and months of trying to get him to recognize the fact that we needed big hunks of green or yellow or whatever
right.
vegetable they might have. And then I learned that he was going to be replaced, so that was a joy. It took a few months, and now we have a chef who not only knows that, but we get served two vegetables, sometimes three, if one wants, on a dinner plate. And it looks good, it tastes good, so much more healthy.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Because and I point out to the audience, folks, that my mom, your sister, and, we were brought up always with fresh vegetables. Always.
Yeah.
Fresh salad,
always.
Broccoli, asparagus, whatever it was always fresh. And so, that's how I was brought up, and I know you were too, so, and you just carried that to your family, and raised a healthy family. You know, so.
Yes, all the boys love vegetables, which is good, of course. They like other things, too, but which aren't so good. But they do love their veggies, and I really think it has helped with my 95-year-old age to try to eat properly. So, and that and other good things. And here we are. We have in the Imperial Valley cantaloupes that are absolutely beautiful and lovely. And, of course, our vineyards. And we have here the best corn in the world, we are told. It's called Slough House Corn. Mm-hmm. And it's raised on the valley floor of a river. And all those nutrients and everything go into it. So it is, one can just pick a peat right off the vine and eat it. And it's delicious.
Oh, that is great. Yeah, I was at a farm last week, Aunt Elizabeth, and their best crops come from the right next to the river.
Yes. You know,
the floodplain.
All the nutrients and everything. And so now we're pretty happy here. I no longer get so many complaints.
Oh, that's great.
We get fish twice a week at least, and one can always order a salad for dinner separately, you know, salad of the week.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're lucky, and I'm happy.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, and you know, folks, it's never too late to be an activist, that's for sure.
Correct. You better start it now.
Yeah, right.
Because it does help.
Yeah, it does. And just to be healthy and knowing that, you know, through your activism, that other people in the community are also healthier.
Well, I think so.
Yeah.
And common sense and mixed with it, but that's nice of you to call. We have very different weather than you all have back there. We get really hot. Today's going to be 90, but it's very, very dry heat. So I've been through your heat on the East Coast.
I know you have.
Yeah. So thank you for the call, Michael.
Oh, my
and
pleasure.
Good luck.
And thank you for all that you do for your community, Aunt Elizabeth.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye for now.
Bye now. Well, that was incredible. I just love talking to her, and she is full of life, as you can tell. Just a wonderful person, and what she has done for her community is really commendable, no doubt. I'd like to get back to Carter a little bit because he does have a few really good things to say.
Incredibly simple blend that would shock your nutritionist, and you're like, how could you be alive on this? You know, as we mature and down that path of food as medicine, I think everybody comes to understand that it's not just what you eat, but how you eat it. We're not just what we eat, we're how we eat. And we're not just how and what we eat, we're how and what we consume. And so our the dollars that we spend obviously are an amazing immediate implication on the landscape around us.
True.
To pay for a thing is to encourage that thing to continue to exist in the world. So does that thing build soil, or does it send soil down the river to the Chesapeake? What agriculture is, the production of food, fiber, things useful to human people from our land and seas, really generally understood. That, at the core of it, in the way in which we engage agriculture most basically, most commonly, every day, is eating. Eating is an agricultural act, to quote the great sage. And eating, also the most intimate engagement with nature. On a day-in, day-out basis, nature becomes us, and we literally project ourselves onto nature. Nature literally takes the image of what we are encouraging of it. So what we find with this, with the idea of food as medicine, is it is a gateway drug. It's a gateway path. It's a lure. It's a fish hook for us to be grabbed and ask, what is really making me sick? What is it? Is it really just apples? Because guess what? There's a lot of impressive people who have some seriously open chakras who don't eat nearly enough that I would even say should keep them alive, and they're doing just fine, right? So there's something else that sustains us. There's something else that sustains culture. There's something else that brings us happiness than, say, needing a certain organic food or needing this and that. And oftentimes, the food as medicine can become an anxiety, you know? So you know, that's not to say anything of this is wrong. It's all just complex, and it's rich, and it's an invitation to go deeper. And that's why I think it benefits us. And, you know, if you're not there, sorry to spoil the ending, but if you are, then you can bask in this. It's really agriculture as medicine, more than it is food. But you got to start somewhere. And for some people, that's food. For me, that was a huge part of it. Wherever you are on the journey, I hope you keep walking.
Well, that gives us an awful lot to think about, Carter. And folks, I encourage you to look more into eating the right things, yes, but also, you know, as Carter said, becoming part of everything around, you know, through yoga, through meditation, whatever your pathway is great. And I just wanted to thank Carter for everything you've given us this morning. Have you got anything else for us, Carter?
Well, you know, these are powerful times we're in. And if there's anything that I feel like I'm meditating on in this season, it's solidarity with the First Peoples of this nation who are putting their bodies and putting their everything on the line to protect water. And water really is quite the meditation. When we think about what water is as a purifier, as a solvent, as a barometer of the health of human culture, are our lives making water more clean or more impure? What is the downstream impact of our life? How is water life? You know, the great naturalist Aldo Leopold said, the water cycle and the life cycle are one, right? And then in the Lakota tradition, the anthem is Mani Wakoni, water is life, right? So how can we look into our religions to pull out that an understanding of that sacrality to enhance the way we experience and use and abuse water? How can we restore a sacred relationship?
Well, I'll tell you what, how can we restore sacred lakes and continue to have clean water? It's a large undertaking, and you know, I've heard that we're probably going to some water wars here at some point, which I don't relish at all, but it's that important. And you see people wasting water or polluting water, and it's kind of sad. But there are ways through activism and through your election, through your vote, these things can be changed. And of course, it starts as one community. So if we got clean water in this area, which we do, a lot of our well water is quite clean and quite good. So we just keep protecting that and make sure that we're not putting things into the soil that then get down into the aquifers. And what I'm talking about are things like Roundup and other herbicides, and then pesticides and chemical fertilizers and all the things that ruin the soil and obviously ruin our food. And when we burn it, it ruins the air. So those are the things you need to survive as a species, obviously, is air to breathe, clean air to breathe, clean water to drink, clean food to eat. And that depends on how clean the soil is. So we've been hearing on To Your Health and from other sources that the demand for organic food is growing and eating food is healthier. Eating food is healthier because chemical fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides are not used. And now we're finding out that this toxic administration in Washington might deregulate what organic is and what it's not, leaving you and me in a wasteland of confusion about what to believe. What the heck is this? What is this, you know? As the weeks roll by and Twitter storms erupting daily, nobody knows what to expect from our federal government. And quite frankly, reading the news can lead to stress overload. And we know stress can lead to early heart, digestive, and brain problems. I mean, you know, can we just get along? Well, the answer is yes, we can. And it's community-based agriculture, which I was talking about with John Hill earlier. And it brings us together. It provides a common ground between folks from different cultures and backgrounds and skin colors. It strengthens and gives voice to the people who, before now, had none. And most importantly, it provides the healthy food we crave and need for our bodies. That's so important. Just imagine if we could feed all or most of the local population with real food and not be dependent on outside political or corporate forces for our nutrition, because they don't care. All they care about is the bottom line. That's all they care about. It's the corporate structure, and it's the model, not necessarily the people. But, you know, the corporate model dictates the bottom line is the only thing. You know, Shakespeare said the play is the thing, and corporations say the bottom line's the thing, without regard to people at all. It doesn't matter. And that's one of the reasons why FDR said that corporations are the enemy of the people. Yes, they do provide jobs. And I talked about this last week. Yes, they provide jobs, but the bottom line's the thing. And if the bottom line is not where it needs to be, they cut jobs. You know, they say, heck, damn, we're going to cut expenses, so we're going to fire all these people. So, you know, in that respect, they really are the enemy of the people, only because of the structure. And that's why corporations should have no political influence, none, zero, because they're the ones that need to be regulated. And if they have influence over the regulators, well, that's like the fox watching the hen house, for sure. And then, of course, that's why our food system, our national food system, is poisoned, literally. So if you continue to eat the national food system products, you will get all sorts of diseases. And when I say that, you may not get the diseases, but your immune system will definitely be ripe for getting diseases, because it will not be strong. And you will get colds during the year, flu, that sort of thing. I used to get a cold every year or two, and doctors said it was normal. Well, then I started eating real food, local, organic. Hey, I haven't had a cold in 10 years, so knock on wood on that, but I'll probably wake up tomorrow with a sore throat and stuffy nose. No, that's not going to happen. But so I haven't been sick in 10 years. I realize that's, anecdotal, but... because it's not over a large number of people. But imagine life with 70% less copays for doctor's visits because we're healthier. Very few incidences of hours lost due to sick days. A life with more energy, increased production at work. And, of course, that leads to less stress. And it also leads to more production, increased but it leads to promotions and pay raises. And these rewards can be achieved by supporting programs like City Schoolyard Gardens and the other programs within the Food Justice Network. There's 16 companies in there. And I urge you to give your time and money to the many of the Food Justice Network organizations and start your journey to a healthier and rewarding life. Hey, thanks for listening, folks. A special thanks to my Aunt Elizabeth and to John Hill on today's show. And remember, eating real food, wearing a smile, and keeping a positive attitude are keys to your health.